Pete Smith, welcome to Powwow.
Thank you very much, David. I love teepees and I love anything with a Red Indian influence, so powwows, hopefully right up my alley.
Oh, fantastic. You're one of the few people who actually got the Native American reference there.
Oh, yes. Too right. I know where you're coming from. So, I can see the smoke signals.
Well done. And may I say, wow, what an honour it is to interview you.
Well, it's very nice to be asked. Thank you very much. You know, when you get to my age, I'm 68, and I've been at Channel 9 in Melbourne. I did a stint in Adelaide too at 9, but I've been here for, 45 years almost.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, time's a bit of a thief, David, as we all probably know, and your listeners will know too. You know, time just goes to nowhere, and you turn around, and all of a sudden, it's all over.
When were you here in Adelaide?
In Adelaide, I was there in the late 70s. I can't swear to about 1978, I did a tonight show on NWS9 for nearly 12 months.
Oh, wow.
That was following in the wake of Ernie Sigley's era.
Way before my time, I'm afraid.
Oh, absolutely, yes. But you might see some old black and white photos kicking around in a museum sometime, and you'll remember the reference.
All right. Well, you're probably best known as being that voiceover guy from Channel 9.
You mean the guy who says, "Sail of the Century," or who used to say it. I hope I'm remember for something more than that, but yes, it is pretty recognisable. It went on for 21 years, so people's evening meal was interrupted with that night after night.
Oh, that's great, because I thought it was going to be really awkward, because I was going to ask you to do that, but I'm glad we've got that out of the way at the start of the interview.
It clears the air, doesn't it?
It definitely.
If it doesn't do that, it clears the earwax.
Tell us, when did you discover you had been blessed with perfect vocal cords?
Oh, look, I don't know. I think going to school, the kids, I don't know what it's like going to school these days, but in my era, back in the, you know, the early 50s, the kids wanted to, at one stage or other, they wanted to be a fireman or a policeman. The girls wanted to be a nurse. It might be the same these days, I don't know. But with us, people like myself and Philip Brady, who works on radio in Melbourne currently, but had a lot of television shows back in the 50s and 60s, Mike Walsh, who now is a theatrical entrepreneur, owns Her Majesty's Theatre in Melbourne. People like that, all my school friends, we wanted to be radio announcers. And unlike the kids who wanted to be policemen, it lasted a lot longer than 2 or 3 weeks. That was our ambition. And even though some of us went to university, that love of radio, there was no TV at the time, that love of radio persisted, and somehow we just fell into it.
Hmm. Well, how did you start out in this crazy world of show business?
I was a messenger boy at the ABC. All I wanted to do was get on radio, because it was a big deal then. You can't cast your mind back that far, but I can tell you that before TV, radio really was bigger than TV ever was. Because, you know, radio, we used to sit around listening to those wonderful serials like Blue Hills on the ABC and The Search for the Golden Boomerang and Superman and all that stuff. As kids, we'd sit on the floor there looking up at the flickering light of the radio, and while it might sound corny now, that was the common man's entertainment.
I try to bring some of that back to my program, although I don't think anyone's listening anymore.
Oh, I'm sure they're listening, and I think with radio, you know, if you've ever been in radio, no matter what happens to you, whether you get into TV or, I mean, there are so many other avenues now to, you know, so many areas of endeavour for people like yourself and maybe even like me still, but, you know, you never lose your love of radio. With radio, you can use your imagination, or the listener is allowed to use their imagination. I can remember when I did all that, those wonderful days with Mick Molloy and Tony Martin. When they teamed up on Drive Time Radio, they had me in as their announcer, and I was involved in a lot of their comedy sketches and stuff. Things that still exist today, actually, on CDs that were made available then. And I remember, you know, Tony and Mick used to go in for a lot of sound effects in their comedy sketches. And I mean, with a sound effect of a waterfall, you've got it straight away in the viewer's mind, but in their imagination. But on television, you've got to spend $1 million to get a waterfall. So it's radio's fantastic and never been bettered.
Well, you mentioned Martin Molloy there. How exactly did you meet Tony Martin and Mick Molloy? Because, of course, there's a considerable age difference, if you don't mind me saying.
Yes, well, I started out as the D generation. And if you're into comedy, Australian comedy, you'll realise that the D generation was the or the breeding ground, if you like, for many of the performers like Tony and Mick later on, and people who went on the Late Show. They many of those original performers from the so-called D generation, they were on radio initially, and that's where I first caught up with them. But then they did the Late Show series for the ABC, and then they became Working Dog and produced hit movies like The Castle and The Dish, and they are now currently, of course, with Channel 10 doing Thank God You're Here, which has been a big success. So those people who started out with Tony and Mick and all that sort of group, Judith Lucy, for instance, they all went on to bigger and better things, and they're still very much a part of the Australian comedy entertainment scene.
Well, you've been involved with so many shows over the years, from In Melbourne Tonight right up to The Nation with Mick Molloy earlier this year. Is there one particular TV show or radio show or film that you've been involved in that you enjoyed more than any of the others?
I loved working with Tony and Mick on their movies, even though I only had very small parts in things like Crackerjack and Tony's movie,
Bad Eggs?
Bad Eggs. I was an aging police officer in that, and I didn't need any makeup, funnily enough, you know. And they were fun things to do, but I've got to tell you, apart from the joy of working with people like Bert and Graham, and Bert is still a dear friend, and we still keep in touch, of course, because he's still at Nine in Melbourne, and so am I in a small way. Apart from working with those dear people in those fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants-live television nights or days, I really think the highlight has been working with people like Tony and Mick, both on television, in The Nation, as you say. Unfortunately, it didn't get the bulk audience that a commercial television station requires to keep it on air, so that went. But I'm sure with their inventive minds, both Tony and Mick are thinking of things anew, and they'll pop up again, for sure. But I guess another happy association was when, sitting in the office I'm in now talking to you here at the Fun Factory, as we affectionately call it, at Television City in Richmond in Melbourne, I was sitting here in this office surrounded by cobwebs and memorabilia from, 50 years of TV, I suppose I've been here so long, and a guy walked through the door, introduced himself and said, "I've just signed with Channel 9 to do a Tonight Show, and I would love you to be our announcer, because, you know, you were there in the Graham Kennedy days, and this is a new show we're doing. It's got a comedy feel to it." And I said, "Oh, yes, what's your name?" And he said, "Sean McAuliffe."
Oh,
now,
wow.
I'll never forget Sean walking through the door. That was our first meeting. He came up and did it on his own bat. I could have said, "Oh, go jump. I don't want to be bothered." But I was absolutely thrilled to be asked. And unfortunately, that series only ran 13 weeks. Again, a terrific series, which I think I've heard Sean is putting out on DVD.
Yeah, that's what the internet tells me as well.
Right, I look forward to seeing some of that, because it was a joy to be, again, just a supporting player in something as inventive as that. And, of course, Sean is on Vue now, isn't he? Pardon the free plug on his new Newstopia show.
Oh, yes, it's on SBS at 10 p.m, I believe, on Wednesdays.
I just think his comedy is sensational. And what is the legal profession's loss is entertainment's gain, as far as I'm concerned. Sean's a very funny guy.
Well, I believe you did the voiceover segment for a segment called Audience Participation, mainly on McAuliffe Tonight. And I've prepared a bit, and I've actually brought a clip here, so, you know, the listeners at home can re-familiarise themselves with how funny that was. Would you mind if I played
it? I'd love to hear it.
On the original Darod's Wheel tonight, Joan, you could win this state-of-the-art audio cassette player from JVC. At $25, music has never sounded so audible. As easy as JVC? A rhetorical question worth pondering. Or how about this fabulous sewing machine from Pfaff? Yes, siree. Whether it be a smart linen suit or one made from the eviscerated skin of your murder victims, then look no further than Pfaff. Pfaff, the P is silent, but my God, the machine isn't. Back to you, Sean.
Ah, that brings back lots of happy memories. I mean, you can hear the inventiveness in the writing.
Oh, definitely.
And then you can hear the audience, and you can't buy that. You can put in canned laughter to support something that's really not up to the mark, but all that was live laughter. It's just music to an entertainer's ears, and to be able to be handed that sort of material and do it on air, just a career highlight, as I said.
Did you do those live, or were they pre-recorded?
No, we did them all live. We were all there live doing them.
Wow.
Yep.
You did very well. You didn't make very many mistakes.
Oh, I think you'll find, if you listen to it all, there were a few fluffs and bits and pieces. But, you know, there's something about everybody sitting in the audience at home. Everybody, every one of us is making mistakes every hour of the day. But you don't have to make excuses for it. And on television, that was part of the joy of that live feel that Sean and everybody who came before him did, and that was that, you know, the immediacy, the flying by the seat of your pants. It's a cliche, I know, but the audience gets the feeling. Now with videotape, we've got wonderful technological advances. You can't tell the difference between tape and live, but it removes, for the entertainer, for the person on camera, it removes that knife edge, you know, that tightrope walk, the emotional part of the act, where you know you haven't got a second chance, you just have to keep going. Mm. I recall once during that wonderful era, the wonderful run that Tony Barber did with Sale of the Century, and Glenn Ridge after him, who picked the show up and made it his own. I remember one year when Tony was doing it, we had the cash jackpot, and that cash jackpot went into hundreds of thousands of dollars towards the end. We had armed guards there and God knows what, because it was, in reality, the money was there. It was in a huge acrylic box that came down from the ceiling when the fanfare went off, and I said, tonight's cash jackpot is, you know, and do all this sort of stuff. Down would come the box, and here would be Tony with the finalist, you know, the guy who's won through for the night, standing there, the lady or gentleman standing there, and the box would come down. Well, this particular night, the big box came down on the fanfare, and I'm singing out, you know, here's tonight's cash, and it hit Tony on the shoulder, and it almost knocked him out. It must have got the side of his head, and mainly on the shoulder, and it must almost knocked him out. Now, Tony kept going, because Tony is a pro, used to doing live television, not used to saying, oh, we'll stop and do that again. And so, unfortunately, with videotape, although you get a very sophisticated finished product, sometimes the rough round the edges pieces are better than making it sophisticated, for want of a better word. And when you stop tape, you take, very often, sometimes take that magic moment out, and you can never get it back.
I have seen that footage somewhere. I remember seeing it on 50 years of television
They'd run that sort of thing. And luckily, they had it. But so many things now, in the next 50 years, you won't see in those retrospective programs, because if something does go wrong, they stop tape. They stop, and they fix it up. And so the golden moment, the outtake, the fluff, is gone. Which is a shame, because sometimes they're the things that get the biggest laughs.
Definitely. I suppose that's almost what radio still has over television, that live aspect.
It has. I mean, you can create it straight away, you know? Hey, there's a big snowball coming down. Look out, David, it's coming into the studio. Look out, it's going to crash through the door. And I mean, immediately in your mind, if it's presented properly, you can see that snowball rolling in towards the studio door, can't you?
I'll have to edit that in later.
Well, you don't need to. I did it so well, you don't need the rumbling effect. Or maybe you do.
Do you like to name drop the various celebrities that you've met over the years during conversations?
I have to do a fair few talks in my job, if you like. You know, most of those engagements are for, fundraising nights and so forth. And when I do, the only thing about getting old, the beauty of it is you have met quite a lot of people, and you have got, hopefully, a few anecdotes that will stop the audience going to sleep. And I think that's, you know, whether it's being a mate of Bert's and sharing some fun times with Sammy Davis Jr. backstage, or meeting Van Johnson, who was one of the MGM star players during the golden years of Hollywood. I mean, you can just reel them off and reel them off, and guess maybe they're only names to you. But, you know, the thing about getting older and having experience is that you do meet these people, and I don't think for personal gain, but it does come in handy when you've got a story or two to tell.
Now, according to your Wikipedia page, which is where I get most of my information from these days, you were awarded an Order of Australia for service to the community.
That's right. I was awarded that honour for most of the charity things I do, which are very kindly under the blessing of the with the blessing of the Nine Network. So in a way, there's a big advantage about being on television or being around so long, because people do know who you are, hopefully, and there's some value in your service to the community, hopefully, when you go out and do a talk or fundraiser.
Did somebody nominate you, or did you just get a call from them?
Nominated. I don't know exactly how the process goes. You've got to be nominated for it, and it's not just one person. It's a rigorous process. I had somebody's name come across my desk a few years ago, and then the next year it came across the desk again, and it wasn't successful, and it was somebody who was very, very deserving too, but it never happened.
Hmm.
Now, it might happen in the future, but they get an enormous number of nominations. And they don't accept them all, of course. So I feel very privileged.
Is an Order of Australia, is it the kind of thing you keep on display on your mantelpiece, or do you keep it locked away?
Well, I mean, some people might. You can actually have it, you know, the medals are quite large, you know, ribbons and medals, you know, say you've saved somebody in the line of fire. But in reality, there are very few opportunities, if any, for you to wear those medals. People in the military can wear them if they go to, you know, a passing out parade or something like that. But ordinarily, when you're asked back to Government House, it really is only the protocol is that you just wear the miniature, what's called the miniature, which is really a very small circle. The Order of Australia, the Australia Medal, which is the next one up, has a little blue circle in the middle of it. It's very subtle, really. It's not huge at all, like you might expect.
Hmm. Very Australian, I would say.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, it is. It's understated, but everybody who's anybody knows the importance of it.
Well, you've also released two nostalgic double CDs featuring the great British dance bands of the 1930s and 40s.
You have done your homework, haven't you?
It's all on Wikipedia.
Oh, is it? Oh.
Yes. What is it about British dance bands from the 30s and 40s? Well, what do they have that, say, the Pet Shop Boys or Barbra Streisand don't?
I personally think they had melody. They had bounce, they had melody, they were bright, the lyrics were incredible, and the reason I like, I love Tommy Dorsey, Glenn Miller and all those American dance bands that were so famous during the war years, but the British dance bands were a completely different sort of feel. Every record that was ever, you know, and they were the pop records of the day, they were released then on the old 78s, you know, before microgrooves came in, but every record that was released was always, whether it was a comedy number or straight love song or whatever, they were always released in strict dance tempo, because apart from the movies, apart from the cinema, dance halls were like Tabaret and Tats Pokies are today. They were on every corner, especially in England and here in Australia too. Dancing, public dancing, was very, very popular. And that wasn't just the dancing when you get where you get up and, you know, sort of stomp your feet and don't touch your partner. This was a chance to hold a girl in your arms. A rare opportunity, I can tell you. I even held a few boys at one stage. You know, I was just finding my way, of course.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
But, you know, the British dance bands, you'd have to play one or subject your listeners to one of those bouncy numbers with the inventive lyrics so that they could see what I'm talking about, I think, to fully explain it. But, and those numbers, you know, really, when you think about the wonderful technological advances in recording today, it's amazing how those numbers come across when you consider that they would have been done with not multiple microphones. There would have been one or two microphones in front of the orchestra, and the vocalist would have had a microphone, of course, because they didn't have 16-track master machines and all this sort of thing.
Mm.
Minis of time, they didn't even have tape recordings when they started in the 30s. All they had was, you know, an acetate disc that the sound was cut into. and that was that became the master. And so there was really, you know, an opportunity only to do it once. But the beauty of those records, some of them on those albums we put out, Bill Armstrong in Melbourne, who's sort of the Australian father of recording engineering, those records we put out, we cleaned up through computer processes and so forth, and took all the hisses and clicks out, you know, the surface noise.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because quite a few of the tracks on the on those CDs were actually recorded, even though it was back in the 30s and into the early 40s, they were recorded at the Abbey Road Studios, long before the Beatles were even born.
Oh,
isn't
wow.
that amazing?
Yeah.
So it's a rich heritage there too.
May I ask, you've done a few films. Have you ever done a nude scene?
No, unfortunately, I was asked to do one in one of, I think it was Tony's film, but unfortunately I didn't have the equipment, so I failed the test. You have to be well endowed now with the giant cinemascope screens and so forth, and unfortunately, no, being a child of the 30s, I didn't have the material. I could have been a star.
Oh, what could have been?
Collect your thoughts, but try not to mentally think about it too much.
Pete Smith, thank you. Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a treat to talk to you, and all the best to your listeners. And all I can say is, see you around like a record. Pete Smith speaking.